From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Every 4 years, there is one day when the people have their say. In many ways, the act of voting and having that vote counted is more important than who wins the majority of the votes that are cast.
Day 20 and still not counting. That's one newspaper's headlines. Al Gore tries to get a Florida court to invalidate the election results. Also today, global climate talks collapse and the U.S., the world's biggest polluter, is being blamed. We'll have a debate on the issue. And finally, you've heard of dimpled, pregnant, and dangling chads. Well, today we go to the other one. We look at the African nation's struggle to bring an ex-dictator to justice. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Lawyers for Al Gore yesterday filed legal challenges contesting George Bush's certified victory in the presidential election in Florida, saying thousands of votes in three counties that could have changed the outcome were unfairly ignored. The Gore campaign said in its complaint the results certified by state election officials on Sunday night, which gave the victory in the key state to Bush by 537 votes, were incorrect. Al Gore defended his unprecedented reach to the courts in a primetime televised address last night, declaring, "Let the people have their say," by counting every ballot in Florida's make-or-break presidential election. The primetime televised address was perhaps Gore's last best chance to explain why the closest presidential election in 124 years didn't end on Sunday night. We'll go to that in just a minute. Meanwhile, George Bush pushed ahead with preparations to take over the U.S. presidency, announcing he would use private funds for the process after being denied public money. The General Services Administration, as arbiter of federal office space, had said it would deny facilities to either side pending outstanding legal cases brought by Al Gore, disputing the Florida vote. But Bush's vice presidential nominee, Dick Cheney, named on Sunday to manage the transition, announced that Clay Johnson, currently Texas Governor Bush's chief of staff, would become the executive director of the transition and that campaign spokesperson Ari Fleischer would be the press spokesperson for the transition. The U.S. Supreme Court announced yesterday it would hear an appeal by Texas death row inmate Johnny Paul Penry. The high court agreed to use the case to clarify how much opportunity jurors in death penalty cases must have to consider the defendant's mental capacity. Penry is supposed to have an IQ between 50 and 63, which is below the 70 required for normal intelligence, and has said he still believes in Santa Claus. The justices will hear arguments in Penry's latest appeal next year, with a decision due by the end of June. For more than a decade, as New Jersey state troopers vigorously followed orders to fight the war on drugs, innocent minority motorists became their victims. Top law enforcement officials knew people of color were targeted, but stopped the practice of racial profiling only after years of complaints, according to thousands of documents released yesterday by the state. Some 100,000 pages of trooper logs and reports, traffic tickets, training guidelines, and citizen complaints were made public. Among the disclosures, at least 8 of every 10 automobiles stopped and searched on the turnpike over the last decade were driven by blacks and Latinos. In a March 99 memo, a top deputy attorney general wrote, "Racial profiling exists as part of the culture. The assumption is made that minorities are drug dealers and cops are encouraged to stop them." A state assemblyman from New Jersey has called on the New Jersey legislature to convene a commission to hold hearings, and the Senate Judiciary Committee plans its own investigation. This international news, Venezuela called home its ambassador to Colombia for consultation yesterday, 3 days after Colombia called home its own ambassador to Venezuela to evaluate the current state of relations between the two countries. Colombian politicians have condemned Venezuela for allowing a spokeswoman for the FARC, the rebels in Colombia, to speak to the legislature in a forum on Colombia's U.S.-backed anti-drug plan. In related news, the U.S. administration will urge Congress to give Colombia's neighbors more money to prevent the escalating war on drugs in Colombia from driving traffickers across its borders. This, according to a senior U.S. official. Undersecretary of State Thomas Pickering, who visited Colombia last week for the fourth time in 16 months, said the U.S. would have to pay more attention to regional aspects of the drug trade as the Colombian offensive begins. The U.S. Congress has approved $180 million for anti-drug programs in the neighboring countries as part of its $1.3 billion package for Colombian President Andres Pastrana's multinational Plan Colombia. And this news from Israel, its hardline opposition today rebuffed a final appeal by Prime Minister Ehud Barak that it join a national emergency government and said it was determined to force early elections with a crucial vote in parliament. The vote to be held late today after several hours of debate is expected to be close. The opposition's confident it could muster the 61 of 120 legislative votes required to get the bill passed. Opposition leader Ariel Sharon in recent weeks unsuccessfully tried to negotiate the terms of a political partnership with Barak, but he said he no longer is interested in an alliance.
It ain't no use to vote in Palm Beach County if you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to vote in Palm Beach County. It don't matter anyhow. When you look to the right of your candidate's name, and the hole and the arrow ain't lined up the same, maybe you're just a little off with your aim. Punch it twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe, like you never done before. No, it ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. There's no way you can vote for Gore. This butterfly ballot was designed just for you, 'cause you're old and liberal and a Jew. Been voting Democratic since 1932. Just punch it twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use to ask for another ballot, babe, if you think you made a mistake. It ain't no use to ask for another ballot, babe. It's how it's done in the Sunshine State. We threw out 15,000 in 96. Relax, it's only politics. Me and the governor, we're tied as ticks. So punch it twice, it's all right. So you might as well vote for Buchanan, babe, the Reform Party nominee. He's on the right side of the ballot, babe. He's as right as he can be. There's not a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and Republicans. George Wallace told us that. So we made it easy to vote for Pat. Just punch it twice, it's all right.
Ross Altman singing Punch It Twice, It's All Right, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Republican George W. Bush is forging ahead with plans to move into the White House as Democrat Al Gore attempts to shore up ebbing support for his battle to contest the U.S. presidential vote in Florida. Flanked by American flags, Gore addressed the nation last night, casting himself as a defender of democracy and the Constitution, and asking people for patience as he contests the presidential vote in Florida. His lawyers filed a lawsuit in Florida yesterday seeking to invalidate the certified election results. This is what he had to say at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time last night.
Every 4 years, there is one day when the people have their say. In many ways, the act of voting and having that vote counted is more important than who wins the majority of the votes that are cast. Because whoever wins, the victor will know that the American people have spoken with a voice made mighty by the whole of its integrity. On that one day, every 4 years, the poor as well as the rich, the weak as well as the strong, women and men alike, citizens of every race, creed, and color, of whatever infirmity or political temper, all are equal. They are equal, that is, so long as all of their votes are counted. A vote is not just a piece of paper. A vote is a human voice, a statement of human principle. And we must not let those voices be silenced. Not for today, not for tomorrow, not for as long as this nation's laws and democratic institutions let us stand and fight to let those voices count. If the people do not, in the end, choose me, so be it. The outcome will have been fair, and the people will have spoken. If they choose me, so be it. I would then commit, and do commit, to bringing this country together. But whatever the outcome, let the people have their say, and let us listen. Ignoring votes means ignoring democracy itself. And if we ignore the votes of thousands in Florida in this election, how can you, or any American, have confidence that your vote will not be ignored in a future election? That is all we have asked since Election Day, a complete count of all the votes cast in Florida. Not recount after recount, as some have charged, but a single full and accurate count. We haven't had that yet. Great efforts have been made to prevent the counting of these votes. Lawsuit after lawsuit has been filed to delay the count and to stop the counting for many precious days between Election Day and the deadline for having the count finished. And this would be over long since, except for those efforts to block the process at every turn. In one county, election officials brought the count to a premature end in the face of organized intimidation. In a number of counties, votes that had been fairly counted were simply set aside. And many thousands of votes that were cast on Election Day have not yet been counted at all, not once. There are some who would have us bring this election to the fastest conclusion possible. I have a different view. I believe our Constitution matters more than convenience. So, as provided under Florida law, I have decided to contest this inaccurate and incomplete count in order to ensure the greatest possible credibility for the outcome. I agree with something Governor Bush said last night. We need to come together as a country to make progress. But how can we best achieve that? Our country will be stronger, not weaker, if our next president assumes office following a process that most Americans believe is fair. In all our hands now rests the future of America's faith in our self-government. The American people have shown dignity, restraint, and respect as the process has moved forward. This is America. When votes are cast, we count them. We don't arbitrarily set them aside because it's too difficult to count them. In the end, in one of God's unforeseen paths, this election may point us all to a new common ground, for its very closeness can serve to remind us that we are one people with a shared history and a shared destiny. So this extraordinary moment should summon all of us to become what we profess to be, one indivisible nation. Let us pledge ourselves to the ideal that the people's will should be heard and heeded, and then together, let us find what is best in ourselves and seek what is best for America. 200 years from now, when future Americans study this presidential election, let them learn that Americans did everything they could to ensure that all citizens who voted had their votes counted. Let them learn that democracy was ultimately placed ahead of partisan politics in resolving a contested election. Let them learn that we were indeed a country of laws. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Vice President Al Gore speaking last night to the nation. Lawyers for both sides must file briefs by the end of the day today with the U.S. Supreme Court, which is hearing a Bush appeal challenging the inclusion of hand-counted ballots in Florida's final election tally. Meanwhile, the Bush team is quietly going ahead with transition plans, although they're locked out of the presidential transition offices in Washington, D.C. The White House has refused to provide either team with access to these offices, saying the presidential race is still unresolved. Republican vice presidential nominee Dick Cheney said yesterday the Bush team would raise private funds to rent office space in Washington. Republican sources said among Bush's first personnel announcements will be retired General Colin Powell, almost certainly as Secretary of State, and Condoleezza Rice as White House National Security Advisor. But those announcements are not expected immediately while the legal battle still rages on. We're joined on the telephone right now by Robert Ritchie, who's Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you first just go through with us where we stand now legally and then how your center is dealing with this uncertainty?
Well, it is now up to the courts. I mean, they're clearly battling for public opinion at the same time. But what will make the difference is what judges decide, because the public at this point isn't going to influence the process beyond creating a climate where the judges maybe make you know different decisions, or the candidates themselves. Gore decides that he doesn't have the support to continue. But the there's different cases going forward. The most important one at this point is the Gore case that he's made to the Florida Supreme Court that the ballots were not fully counted, and that involves the decision in Miami-Dade to not do the recount. The decision by the Secretary of State to not allow Palm Beach to finish its recount and therefore not count any of its recounted ballots, and then a couple other specific incidents where they feel they can cobble enough votes together to get well more than they need.
Can you explain the Miami-Dade decision not to count the votes? I mean, you're talking about Democratic counties. Did it have to do with the near Republican riot as people tried to break through the doors where they were counting?
Well, what they're saying publicly is that they felt they just couldn't get the count done, and just as the Secretary of State didn't allow Palm Beach to give partial results, you know, maybe they were feeling that they would, you know, they would do all this hard work on a Thanksgiving weekend and have it all go for naught, which it probably would have given what the Secretary of State has done. But there was at the same time certainly an apparent connection between this very noisy protests with, of course, a history of some violence in that area by people who get passionate about issues, and that clearly could have been an act of intimidation. But at this point, they're certainly not saying that's why they did it.
The emphasis has not been about violations of the Civil Rights Act, the tens of thousands, it's believed, of votes of people of color who were discouraged from or in some way harassed at the polls or stopped from voting, perhaps being told they weren't on the voting rolls. You have Duval County, where in some cases a third of the black vote wasn't counted, up to 27,000 votes not counted. But the Democrats aren't challenging this, saying they found out too late in the game the number of votes that had been invalidated.
Right, and it's there could be a practical question about that, or perhaps just not wanting to bring the system to as much scrutiny as it could. I mean, the system itself is on trial here, and I think it's in some ways being found guilty of not being nearly as democratic as we all would like it to be. And by narrowly focusing on the specific matters that they've raised about like counting the ballots that were cast validly that just haven't been finished counting, the Gore campaign feels that that's narrow enough that they can get a relatively quick judgment from the court. I mean, the other issues we must not forget, because they really are the ultimate lesson that we must learn from this, that there's a whole range of ways that our votes don't count in our democracy. And as, you know, Mr. Gore said himself, you know, ignoring votes means ignoring democracy itself. And these quotes, a vote is a human voice. And, you know, these are the quotes that we need to build upon, because that indeed is true. And, of course, many times our votes and voices are silenced. But by keeping it narrowly focused, the campaign can try to get a quick resolution and still get enough votes to move ahead in the count, or at least that's its hope.
Robert Ritchie, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask what kind of work you've been doing with Lonnie Guinier lately, and also what proportional representation has to do with all this. Has it taken any steps forward in this confusion? Robert Ritchie is the head of the Center for Voting and Democracy. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rule. As we wrap up with Robert Ritchie, Executive Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy in Tacoma Park, Maryland, the work you're doing with Lonnie Guinier, who is called all sorts of names, including, to say the least, that she was undemocratic in the kind of issues she was pushing around voting. Robert Ritchie.
Yes. Well, Lonnie has stayed firm in advocating changes to our voting system that would allow more of our votes to count, and count in the sense that they don't just get tallied, but they actually count toward representation and giving people their kind of a fair share of power. And that certainly comes up in this situation when we're talking about the sacredness of every vote, but clearly more than half the people in Florida will have voted for someone who isn't getting anything out of Florida, and that's how we typically do things with a winner-take-all voting system, and that's something that we can change. And most democracies have something different, which is where if you're part of a like-minded group of voters that gets 10% of the vote, whether that be a racial minority or a political minority, you can win your fair share of seats, 1 out of 10 seats. And that's one of the, you know, if every vote is a voice, then we need to allow all the voices to have a chance to participate and then be represented. And there's some very good things going on out there. And as we head into redistricting and controversies over minority voting rights, which yesterday was before the Supreme Court on the North Carolina case, we need to remember that there are good ways to represent all of us in a lot better way than we do now.
Is there more attention being paid to proportional representation, the issue that your group focuses on?
It sure is, and there's a lot of localities have moved to it. Actually, Texas Governor George Bush signed a bill a few years ago to allow school boards to go to cumulative voting, which is one of these proportional systems in Texas, and a number have, in including Amarillo, Texas, the other idea tied to the presidential race that's getting a lot of attention at a statewide level, Vermont, Alaska, New Mexico, and elsewhere, is one that would have allowed those people who voted for Ralph Nader and other minor party candidates to go ahead and express their choice between the major candidates as well. And that would better assure that we get a majority winner and kind of undo this whole spoiler tag that is such a painful hurdle for any third-party candidate.
If people want to get in touch with the Center for Voting and Democracy, where do they call or go on the web?
They go on the web to www.fairvote.org, and they can that's fairvote.org, in one word, fairvote. And they can call us in Tacoma Park, Maryland at 301-270-4616. We also have staff now in California and Vermont and more work is going on in regions, and there's a lot of great opportunities to work at a state level. So we would urge people to contact us.
Well, thanks for being with us, Rob Ritchie of the Center for Voting and Democracy, as we move on now to our major debate of the day, and that is the collapse of the global warming talks that happened over the weekend at The Hague. After 2 weeks of negotiations, the UN talks that sought to cut global warming collapsed. Many have laid the blame at the feet of the United States, the world's biggest polluter. The conference had sought agreement on implementing a pact reached in Kyoto, Japan in 1997, which had called for a 5% average cut in developed nations' 1990 levels of emissions of gases such as carbon dioxide by the year 2010. The warming that scientists predict over the next century could cause seas to rise, an increase in violent storms, an expansion of drought-stricken areas, and the spread of epidemics such as malaria and dengue. Developing nations, considered most at risk from higher temperatures, poured scorn on the failure of the gas-guzzling rich nations to stop squabbling over the cost and unite to tackle climate change. The United States, which is the world's top polluter, pushed a plan to allow nations to count carbon dioxide soaked up by forests, so-called carbon sinks, against emissions targets. We're joined right now by three students who went to the Hague conference. They are Matt McLaughlin, a senior at Pennsylvania State University, Daniel Jones, a sophomore at Hunter College in New York, and Mary Westervelt, a senior at the College of William and Mary from Williamsburg, Virginia. Let's start with Matt McLaughlin. Why were you at The Hague? What did you do there?
We were there as students representing the young people of America, trying to make the statement to our delegates and to the entire world that climate change was, we see, as a moral issue, and we thought that it was imperative that they work on climate change right now, that the American people want action on climate change, and that we were upset with the way our delegation was representing us because it really was basically the American delegation standing in the way of any action on climate change at this conference.
What did you do there?
I participated in a whole lot of actions throughout the week that I thought were extremely clever that different people had thought up. Probably my favorite one was on Thanksgiving Day. A huge percentage of our students fasted for that entire day, which sort of is a huge contrast to what people were doing back in the United States on that day. And we wore armbands that said, "Ask me why I'm fasting," because I think just simply saying that we were fasting would not make a lot of sense to most of the world who aren't aware of what Thanksgiving means to the United States. And then when people asked us, we told them that Thanksgiving was supposed to be a day for warming hearts, not warming the planet, and that we were not thankful for the way that our delegation was representing the people of the United States, and that we thought the people of the United States would much prefer to see responsible action on climate change that would help mitigate the effects that are going to affect the third world much more than our own country, and that the inaction was not the moral high ground that we should be taking.
Mary Westervelt, what about you? You spent your Thanksgiving break at The Hague instead of home eating Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, I did participate in the fast because, as Matt said, we felt that Thanksgiving is a day in which we celebrate how far we've come during the year, all that we have to be thankful for, and we felt that that was not an appropriate action to be taking during the climate talks because we had yet to see the United States represent us as we felt that we needed to be represented.
What actions were you involved with?
Well, one of my favorites was delivering coal to some of the major delegate groups that were pushing for fossil fuels. We wore Santa hats and sang them global warming carols and delivered coal to represent their position, which we felt was very naughty rather than nice.
And Daniel Jones, there was a profile on you in the New York Times over the weekend that talked about what you were doing there. But tell us.
Well, we participated in several actions also. I mean, we not only talked to delegates and representatives of Congress, but one of my favorite actions was standing outside the conference center and singing Christmas carols, modified Christmas carols about global warming trying to raise awareness. We got a lot of media attention for that.
On a student field trip, the headline says, with the planet at stake. Well, maybe the three of you could sing one of your Christmas carols that you sang for U.S. delegates and others from around the world.
We'd be happy to.
Which one?
Jingle Bells.
Okay, do you all know that?
I have the words.
Okay.
I don't have the words in front of me, so you guys are going to have to take this one.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Ready.
Okay. Hot as hell, ocean swell, warmer every day. Oh, what fun it is to fry in a world with climate change. Hot as hell, ocean swell, warmer every day. Oh, what fun it is to fry in a world with climate change. Driving through the city in a one-ton Chevrolet. Sampling everything pretty, laughing all the way. Ha, 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 if we don't take a stand. A planet soon will fry. No, no more time to laugh and sing like we are doing tonight. Oh, hot as hell, ocean swell, warmer every day. Oh, how glad we would be without climate change. Hot as hell, ocean swell, warmer every day. Oh, how glad we would be without climate change.
Well, what kind of effect did your songs have?
Well, a lot of the delegates from other countries came over and clapped for us and said yay, but a lot of the U.S. delegates just walked right on past. You know, we did get a lot of attention for it, and I think every little action we do that has that sort of effect is very important.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the week, we were hearing from delegates from third world nations that they really appreciated what we were doing there, and that they really felt that we were there to help them out and to represent them better than they were almost doing for themselves, because we were the ones right in the face of the U.S. delegates when they walked throughout the convention center saying, look, we have to do something about this. This is a problem that we need to deal with now, and we can't grandstand on this anymore. We can't have any more loopholes. We have to do something.
Hmm. Well, we are joined by representative of the U.S. government. David Sandlow is with us, Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science. You attended the summit at The Hague. A lot of people are blaming the U.S. for the collapse of the talks. What was the U.S. position? Why did these talks collapse?
Let me just start by saying that the Greenpeace students over there were one of the best parts of the whole conference, in my view. They came over and provided tremendous positive energy. I had a chance to talk to about 250 of them during the middle of the conference. They asked me tremendous questions. And then throughout the conference, I think, really just added a sense of the long term. You know, climate change is a challenge that we have to get started working on today, and it's something we have to keep working on for decades ahead. So in my mind, one of the real positive parts of this conference was having students over there committed to solving this problem and committed to devoting their careers to addressing it. Now, to answer your question, you said a lot of people are blaming the United States. That's inevitable in any situation like this. But as you know, too, the Europeans are busy blaming each other over this far more than the United States. And what happened here is that the European delegation made a deal, but then when they went back at the last minute, it broke down within the councils of the European governments, and then they were not prepared to go forward and negotiate further because the deadline had passed and some of their ministers had other appointments and needed to leave the city. So I think we all are saddened by that chain of events, but we need to keep going. We need to keep up with this fight, which is it's so critical for the future of our planet. The U.S. position is one shaped by desire to solve this problem and march forward using all the tools available to us. There are at least three pieces that I think we need to focus on. One of them is aggressive emission reductions in the United States right here at home, and we need to move forward and do that in our utility sector, in a variety of other sectors as well. A second is using forests and farmlands because they're a central part of the carbon cycle, and they offer tremendous opportunities for helping to address this problem. And finally, we need to use emissions trading, which is a tool that we've used to fight acid rain and other pollutants here in the United States with just tremendous success. Starting in 1990, we used emissions trading to fight sulfur dioxide pollution here in the United States. It's led to innovation. It's led to cheaper emissions reductions. It's led to faster reductions in pollution than anybody imagined.
Davis. Let me bring Kurt Davis into the discussion, campaigner with Greenpeace USA's climate campaign. You were at the talks. Your response to the Assistant Secretary David Sandilow of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science.
I agree with David that there's probably some shared blame, but it seemed like with every controversy, the U.S. was right in the middle of it and seeming to hold a hard line when others wanted to come to the table. I also agree that we need aggressive emissions reductions here at home, and that seemed to be a sticking point in this meeting. In fact, all three of the fronts that Mr. Sandilow just mentioned, the aggressive emissions reductions on the home front, that is utilities, vehicles, getting our emissions down, then forests and farmlands and emissions trading, all were key sticking points. First of all, the Europeans were pushing for a cap on how much emissions trading could happen, that is, forcing domestic action versus allowing countries like the U.S. to buy emissions credits overseas. And the U.S. resisted that. The language ended up being a little bit fuzzy, saying we should do it primarily abroad, but what does primarily mean? Does it mean 51% or 70%? And then forests and farmlands, the U.S. basically has an enormous advantage here because we have an enormous country. We have a lot of forests and farmlands. If we take credit for all that we might in that sector, it would be an entitlement to burn more fuel and coal. We don't think that's right as Greenpeace. Many environmental groups think that that is not equitable. Of course, it would help solve the problem in the short term if we solve some of our land management problems, but it should not create an entitlement to burn more fuel. And that's the basic problem, basic logjam we're in right now.
Glenn Kelly is also with us, executive director of the Global Climate Coalition, which is the trade group that represents the oil companies, coal, and other energy and transportation companies. Is the Global Climate Coalition pleased that the talks collapsed?
Well, we were actually disappointed that the talks didn't produce more detail in terms of trying to flesh out many of the broader points agreed to in Kyoto. And we look at the Kyoto Protocol as an outline with many details yet to be resolved, such as what your guests were just talking about with regard to emissions trading, carbon sequestration and sinks, and many other aspects, enforcement and compliance. We don't have all of the details of what the protocol would mean for the United States, for consumers and families and workers and the economy in general. We were hopeful that COP6, the meeting that just took place in The Hague, would resolve those outstanding issues so that we could get a better understanding of just exactly how much the protocol would cost, how much lifestyles would be forced to change, and that would give an opportunity for the United States Senate to consider the protocol. You know, they haven't been given that chance yet. The Kyoto Protocol, agreed to in 1997, is essentially sitting somewhere, we think, in the White House or possibly at the State Department, because it hasn't been submitted to the Senate because the details haven't been worked out. And we were hoping that this meeting would resolve that.
Well, Daniel Jones.
I would counter that argument that the Global Climate Coalition and industry, which is backed by the Global Climate Coalition, is they really were a hindrance there. They really opposed a lot of what was going on at the conference, and I think they stand to take a lot of the blame for the U.S. being so obstinate in the face of this this treaty. I went to one of the soirees put on by the International Atomic Energy Agencies, and they were just basically inviting these Congress people, these U.S. Congress people and delegates coming in and wining them and dining them. They were there's a lot of situations like that. They had press conferences where they invited delegates to come in and watch what was going on, what their position was, all sorts of things. I think the industry really tried to pull in the U.S. with money, with wine, with cheese, all sorts of things, bringing them in and telling them, do not take action on global warming.
Glenn Kelly of the Global Climate Coalition.
Well, I'm not quite sure what your guest was talking about there. We were there.
That's Daniel Jones, by the way, who's a sophomore at Hunter College, one of the group of hundreds of students who went to observe at The Hague and be delegates there.
I had a very good opportunity to interact with a number of the students there. We're curious about what our role and what our positions were. And I thought it was an outstanding opportunity for the students who participated to really learn about the whole process involved in coming up with international treaties and the way. I'm sure it was quite frustrating for many of them.
But you were trying to,
learn.
Sorry, Daniel. I'm sorry, but we had a meeting with you. We had a talk with you on Friday, I believe it was Friday, where basically you were telling us your position, telling us why you were trying to corrupt the process. That's basically what you were doing. It was one of your people who was up there on the panel from the nuclear industry was telling us that the reason why we should invest in nuclear energy in the through the treaty is because we feel really bad about third world people who can't study or read because they don't have lights, which can't be powered unless it's by nuclear energy.
Well, I think you're referring to one of the trade groups that does represent the nuclear industry here in the United States. They're not a member of the Global Climate Coalition. They'd have to speak for themselves.
But do you not back their stance?
I'm sorry, Daniel. I was trying to answer the interviewer's question. We didn't have any press conferences there. We were there as observers trying to assess what was going on with regard to the negotiations, because businesses, whether they're large and small, and by the way, we do represent very large businesses, but we also represent very small businesses, talking about family farmers and small mom-and-pop businesses throughout the United States. Many businesses have to plan very far into the future, and it's important for them to have the details of what they're potentially going to be faced with by way of regulation or laws and treaties that might be coming down the pipe somewhere. So that's what we were there to do, is observe that so that we could understand what its impact would be.
Kurt Davis?
That sounds far too passive for me. I mean, we know the history of the Global Climate Coalition. 3 years ago during Kyoto, they ran a multi-million-dollar ad campaign to try to defame this process and derail it. I'm sure they threw a big party on Saturday night when this thing fell apart, and they're pleased with any delay on a real result.
I went to sleep on Saturday night, Curtis.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. Kurt Davis, campaigner with Greenpeace. David Levy will be joining us in a minute, professor of economics at University of Massachusetts, as well as Daniel Jones, a Hunter College student, and David Sandlow, Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Glenn Kelly is also with us, Executive Director of the Global Climate Coalition, the trade group representing the oil, coal, and other energy industries. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
I've been thinking about how to talk about green. I've been thinking about how to talk about green. I've been wondering if I could sing about green. Trying to find a way to talk about green.
Talk about green.
Green is a poison rising in this land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops his working, never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping.
I've been thinking about how to talk about green.
I've been wondering
if I could sing about green.
Trying to find a way to talk about green.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the collapse of the Global Climate Summit that took place at The Hague this past weekend, after 2 weeks of negotiations, the talks on cutting greenhouse emissions collapsed, and the 160 or so nations went home, along with a number of non-governmental organizations from around the world and hundreds of students who had come to observe the process. Our guests are Kurt Davis, a campaigner for Greenpeace USA's climate campaign, David Sandlow, Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science, who attended the summit at The Hague. By the way, David Sandlow, the first in charge, Frank Loy, he got pied, didn't he? A victim of the global pastry uprising.
yes, he did, and handled it with remarkable grace. And I have to say one thing that I know he and other members of the U.S. delegation appreciated was the quick statement from U.S. environmental groups uniformly deploring that type of behavior. I think that was that type of conduct was by no means typical. In fact, it was extraordinarily unusual at the conference. By and large, there was just a tremendous dialogue with NGOs, which I think made a big difference in the conference.
David Levy, you weren't a part of that dialogue. You weren't even at The Hague, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, but you've been fiercely critical of the industry-state alliance on global climate change negotiations. Can you share your observations on what happened?
Well, that's right. I've been following these negotiations for quite a few years, and it seems clear to me that the positions of the major countries generally track the positions of their major industries. You know, until 1996, the U.S. position was against any mandatory controls of greenhouse gases at all. When Tim Wirth, who was the chief negotiator at the time, reversed that position in 1996, he made it very clear that industry concerns would be accommodated in a market-based regime. Tim Wirth talked about the genius of the private sector, the magic of the marketplace being brought to bear to solve these problems. What we see is the magic of the marketplace becomes magical accounting, in which there will be a lot of fudging, a lot of room for hedging and lack of verification. The Global Climate Coalition was organized very, very early on and was a very, very strong, powerful voice, which really created paralysis in the U.S. administration in trying to address this issue. And now the U.S. is in a very awkward position, trying to move forward without betraying the industry and the major industries which are behind it. Although it should also be said that the Global Climate Coalition doesn't represent the dominant voice of industry anymore. You know, a lot of companies left recently. We had, you know, BP and Shell, well, there were European companies leaving in 97, 98, but Ford left in December 99, and the Global Climate Coalition was even forced to reorganize without individual corporate membership. We've seen the growth of the Pew Center, which has a number of companies such as Boeing, DuPont, a bunch of, now there are 28 members, I see that IBM just recently joined, a bunch of companies saying that a mandatory treaty wouldn't be such a bad thing. In fact, they might see some profitable opportunities. So there is a sea change going on. More and more industries are beginning to recognize that mandatory controls wouldn't be the end of the world for them. So in that sense, the GCC is somewhat of an anachronism. Nevertheless, the U.S. is still stuck in this very difficult position and trying to find a path to meet its commitments, the 7% reduction, without doing very much at home.
Explain the carbon sinks and the trading that's going on.
Well, emission trading is, you know, in principle a good idea. One of the main problems here
is... Explain it for people who've never heard of this concept before.
Okay, the emissions trading essentially allows one country to buy credits from another country. So if the U.S. has committed to reduce its emissions by 7% from the 1990 base level, by the way, the main problem the U.S. is facing is that its emissions are already 13% above 1990 levels. So it would already have to reduce its emissions by 20% in order to reach this target. So it's a moving target, and the target is getting harder to reach. So in order to reach that target, the U.S. is proposing, instead of reducing emissions at home, to buy credits from other countries that might have found it easier to reduce their emissions. And the main criticism here is that there are several countries sitting on what gets called hot air, billions of tons of emissions, which they are no longer emitting because their economies collapsed, primarily the Soviet Union and the Ukraine, which, because after 1990 their economies collapsed, they're no longer emitting nearly as much carbon dioxide as they used to, and the U.S. wants to be able to buy those credits. In other words, nothing is really going to change.
There are criticisms, but there are also huge opportunities here, and I think it would be wrong to ignore them, I think.
David Sandala.
Thank you. The biggest opportunity is something...
Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans, Environment, and Science.
Thank you. The biggest opportunity is something that is called the Clean Development Mechanism under the treaty, and the idea is a tool for investment in developing countries in projects that reduce emissions. And I think lots of observers consider this to be one of the most powerful tools out there for promoting sustainable development around the world. And the idea is similar to what Professor Levy was describing, that is, if a U.S. company would find it cheaper to meet some of its obligations by investing in, say, a renewable energy project in the developing world, it would do that, and it would satisfy some of its obligation to reduce emissions at home. Now, the Clean Development Mechanism is not and should not be the sole answer to solving this problem, and nobody is suggesting that. But one of the tremendous developments from the past couple of years has been a growing global enthusiasm for this tool for both reducing emissions and fighting poverty around the world.
Well, again, this is David Levy. Again, the devil is in the details. The Clean Development Mechanism as a process of technology transfer of helping development in poorer countries could potentially contribute toward this problem. The question is, what kinds of projects are going to be allowed? Just as an example, the International Energy Agency has estimated that over 200 large gas power plants, are likely to be built in the next decade in developing countries, even without the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism. What is going to happen is that companies like Enron, who build these kinds of plants, are going to claim that these plants are instead of coal plants that might have been built and try and claim the carbon credits. In a similar way, we're going to see companies claiming that they are preserving forests that might have been cut down otherwise, and that's going to preserve carbon and will claim the credits. So it's very, very difficult under these mechanisms to see what are going to be the additional carbon reductions, the supplementary carbon reductions. And the negotiations broke down along these lines. The U.S. was looking for very weak compliance mechanisms. It was looking to see almost any project, any new gas facility could be claimed as a carbon credit, whereas in fact these things might have happened anyway.
Let me ask David Sandler. We're in the midst of this election day that has been extended since November 7th. Still don't know who the next president will be. And a lot of people had the criticism that there wasn't much difference between the Democrats and the Republicans overall, even though Gore has been called the environmental vice president when it comes down to action, that in a lot of ways hasn't been better than the Republicans. You have George W. Bush, who says that he opposes the Kyoto Protocol, and during the debate said the science of global warming is uncertain. And yet you have Gore, who at this global warming climate, his administration did not come through with a final proposal. The talks collapsed and many are blaming the U.S. What is your response to that? Now, if Bush is president, it moves to Bonn and Germany, some talks that'll take place in a few months. What difference does it make between the Republicans and the Democrats?
Correct the record. I mean, the United States, of course, as I think you know, came forward with a proposal, and it was actually agreed by the European negotiators, who then left, couldn't get agreement within the European Union as a whole, and then didn't come back to renegotiate in the last hours of the conference. So the particular deal fell apart because of kind of governance issues within the European Union in the last hours of this conference. But there's a bigger issue here, which is really the extraordinary leadership that both Bill Clinton and Al Gore have shown on this issue over the course of their administration. Al Gore literally wrote the book on this issue and has taken steps, including flying to the Kyoto meeting in Japan in 1997 to make sure that meeting was a success, that have really helped put this issue at the forefront of global diplomacy. I mean, I had the privilege of working on the White House staff for a number of years and can tell you that Bill Clinton, on a regular basis, raises this issue with foreign leaders, and when he does so, does it with gusto and enthusiasm, and it's clearly a passion and commitment of his. So that both the president and vice president have worked hard for years to address this problem, and I suspect that's something they intend to continue to do.
Well, I want to thank everyone for being with us. Assistant Secretary of State David Sandelow for Oceans, Environment, and Science, who attended the Global Climate Change Summit that collapsed at The Hague. Glenn Kelly, Executive Director of the Global Climate Coalition. David Levy, Professor of Economics at University of Massachusetts. I'm going to give Daniel Jones, sophomore at Hunter College in New York, the last word, who was at the event.
Well, I would like to thank David Sandelow for being so welcoming for us students. But I do think, as students, we are still united and opposed to what the U.S. is trying to do. They're still seeking a lot of loopholes through the Clean Development Mechanism, seeking non-sustainable energies through carbon sinks, seeking more trees to soak up carbon as credits, and that will not result in a treaty that will defend sustainable energy and promote what we are looking for as a reduction in emissions. So we will be in Bonn, and we will be in Morocco next at the COP7, and we'll be there to oppose the U.S. consistently as long as you take this stance.
Daniel Jones, thanks for being with us. And in this last few minutes, we're going to go back, well, to a word that has become very familiar in this country, but we'll look at it in another context, and that is Chad. While in Florida, the debate continues about Chads, dimpled, pregnant, and otherwise, we're going to look at the other Chad. That's the African nation. A judge in Chad last week threw out criminal complaints against the accomplices of former Chadian dictator Hussein Habre, whose regime was responsible for tens of thousands of political murders and systematic torture. The in-court case is unprecedented in Africa. Chadians are pursuing the brutal former dictator. Many of his collaborators still hold powerful positions in Chad. He now is in exile in Senegal. Human rights activists say the legal action was largely inspired by the campaign to prosecute former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. We're going to go down to Chile right now to Reed Brody, who's the advocacy director for Human Rights Watch and who was pivotal in the Chad case. Can you tell us the latest developments in the case against Hussein Habre?
Yes, Amy. As you said, the Chadian victims have pursued both Hussein Habre himself in Senegal, where he is in exile, and earlier this year he was indicted in Senegal. A court there has thrown out the case, and the case is now on appeal before Senegal's highest court. At the same time, many of Habre's collaborators are still in the current Chadian government, and in a move that would have been unthinkable a year ago, and that was made possible by Habre's arrest in Senegal and the feedback that brought in Chad. They met with the victims met with the new president. The president promised he said the time for justice had come, and the victim said, "Well, in that case, we're going to file suit here against the people in your administration who worked with Hissen Habre." They filed 17 different lawsuits. As you mentioned, a judge last week threw out those lawsuits, and the victims have appealed. The judge said that the government needed to create a special court to try Habre's collaborators, and part of the appeal is going to be to see whether such a court can be created.
And the parallels to where you are right now in Chile?
Well, it's very, you know, here in Chile, 2 years ago, General Pinochet would have been considered totally immune. Since General Pinochet was arrested in London, the courts have stripped him of his immunity here. There are 100 cases pending against him. Just last week, an Argentine judge requested General Pinochet's extradition to Argentina for the murder of former military chief Prats, who was murdered in Buenos Aires.
We have 20 seconds.
And so just as the London arrest of Pinochet broke the myth of his immunity and opened up things in Chile, so the Dakar arrest of Habre has given new possibilities for accountability in Chad and in Africa.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us with that brief update. Reed Brody, campaign director at Human Rights Watch, advocacy director there, speaking to us, though, from Santiago, Chile. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Our website is democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. Matthew Finch is our engineer from the studios of WBAI in New York. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!